Are your kids too heavy? Too thin? Hopefully this isn't something you or they worry about too much, but these days, body image, food, and health concerns are front of mind for many adults and children alike. Journalist Virginia Soul Smith tackles this issue in the new book, Fat Talk: Parenting in the Age of Diet Culture. Virginia has written for the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and Slate, and she joins us now to share five of her big ideas.
Hi, I'm Virginia Soul Smith. I'm the author of Fat Talk, Parenting in the Age of Diet Culture. I also write the Burnt Toast newsletter and host the Burnt Toast podcast, and I've been a health journalist for almost 20 years. For about the first decade or so of my career, I wrote a lot of articles on what you would expect: how to eat less, how to move more, and how to lose weight. About 10 years ago, though, I started to really look into the science on weight and health and realized that I, and most other mainstream journalists, as well as all of our public health messaging and our entire medical model, had gotten a lot of things wrong. Fat Talk explores what we've all gotten wrong about childhood obesity in particular, and what we can do differently to raise happy, healthy kids at every size. Here are five insights from my book. Number one, weight is not a good predictor of health. None of the research shows a causal relationship between high body weight and poor health outcomes. Lifestyle habits, your eating habits, your sleeping habits, your exercise habits, tell us a little bit more about someone's health picture, but even they drive health outcomes far less than genetics or social determinants of health. Things like poverty and experiences of chronic oppression, which you really don't have any control over. We also know that research shows that folks with a higher point on the body mass index actually tend to live longer than folks with normal or low BMI. That may be because weight is sometimes protective. Higher BMI patients do better with conditions like osteoporosis and cancers, and also recover faster from heart surgery. And it may be because weight just doesn't impact health as much as we think. The real danger to a child or anyone in a larger body is how we treat them for having that body. Fat people are less likely to access healthcare, less likely to be treated with dignity and respect by healthcare providers, less likely to be referred for additional testing or other follow-up care, and much less likely to be believed about their own health. It sounds counterintuitive, but one of the most important things parents can do to benefit their children's health is to take weight out of every health-related conversation. Number two, intentional weight loss isn't healthy or sustainable for the vast majority of people. Studies show that 80 to 95% of dieters will lose a small amount of weight in the first 6 to 9 months on a diet and then regain that plus some within the next 2 to 5 years. We don't fail at dieting because we lack discipline or willpower. Our bodies are responding exactly the way our bodies are supposed to respond to restriction. Our metabolism slows down, our hunger hormones increase, and we become preoccupied with food. Your body evolved to do this because this is how you survived famines in times of food scarcity. And your body doesn't know that you're not going through a famine, you're just trying to do paleo. So it responds the way it's supposed to defend your set point. But even if dieting did work and people could lose weight this way, we wouldn't want kids to diet, which is what's happening right now. 38% of kids aged 13 to 16 have tried to lose weight in the past year. 28% of kids aged 8 to 15 have made persistent attempts to lose weight. This is really dangerous. We know that childhood dieting, along with experiences of weight-based teasing and shaming, are the top predictors of future eating disorder risk. Teenage girls who dieted at a severe level were 18 times more likely to develop eating disorders than those who did not. And even moderate dieters, following advice from their doctors or their parents, were 5 times more likely to progress to an eating disorder. Intentional weight loss does not work for most people. It does not improve health markers any more than simply making lifestyle changes or taking medication to treat specific health conditions. And it causes a ton of harm. Idealizing thinness reinforces anti-fat bias. Anti-fat bias is the hatred of fatness that results in the systemic stigmatization of fat people. We know that fat folks have a harder time accessing high-quality healthcare. We know that they tend to earn less. We know that they have trouble fitting into public spaces, restaurant booths, airplane seats, and they often cannot get clothes that fit in most retail outlets. Researchers began to document the existence of anti-fat bias with studies in the 1960s, where they showed kids pictures of children with different body types and abilities, and found that kids consistently rated the fat body as the one they liked the least. In 2012, researchers revisited the picture ranking experiment from the 60s with a group of 415 American 5th and 6th graders, and found that anti-fat bias had only intensified. They noted the difference in liking between the healthy and obese child was currently 40% greater than in 1961. The more we claim to understand and care about the health of fat children, it seems the less we like them. The existence of anti-fat bias also begets thin privilege. Thin privilege means never having to worry if you'll fit in the seat at a restaurant, on an airplane, or in your friend's dining room. It's knowing you can eat an ice cream cone in public or skip a workout, and whatever internal struggle you might feel about those decisions, you will not be judged or ridiculed for the choice by others. It's the fact that you can shop in any clothing store and be confident that they'll have your size. You have thin privilege when you mostly see people with bodies roughly like yours, tanner maybe, much better dressed, but not worlds apart in size or shape, in a magazine, in a movie, or on social media. Thin privilege, like white privilege and male privilege, is a slippery and often controversial concept. It can be invisible to anyone who has it and glaringly obvious to everyone else. That's because we're conditioned not to notice any form of discrimination that doesn't apply directly to us, whether it's happening around us or we are directly perpetrating it. Number 4. The most important nutritional need that kids and adults have is getting enough food. This is true even if you think your kids aren't getting enough protein. Even if you can't remember the last time they ate a green vegetable, even if they fill up on afternoon snacks and then eat 2 bites of dinner, even if they consistently measure at the very low or very high end of your pediatrician's growth chart. Vegetables are great. Protein is great. But if kids are able to eat enough food to have the energy they need to learn, play, and grow, and barring any serious nutrient deficiencies, allergies, or other medical conditions, parents can generally trust the details of what they eat will work out. We don't need to require broccoli in order to eat dessert. We don't need to force 3 kinds of produce into the lunchbox every day. We can do our job by offering a wide range of nourishing foods, including treats, and let kids be in charge of how much and even whether they eat the food we're offering. You may be surprised to see that after a while, your kids are less fixated on treats and sugar than they were when you had more rules around them. You may also have kids who always enjoy treats and sugar because these are delicious foods, and kids need sugar. It's part of how they grow. But what you can get to with this kind of approach towards feeding is kids who don't have a fraught relationship with the foods that were previously forbidden. They can enjoy cookies, they can enjoy broccoli, and they can move on with their day. Taking the focus off nutrition is not neglecting your responsibility to nourish your kids. It means you're honoring and prioritizing the nourishment of your kids as an important aspect of life and well-being. This goes far beyond the nutrient profile of what's on their plate. Number 5. We can't protect our kids from ever encountering diet culture and anti-fat bias, but we can talk to them about it. We can teach them to ask questions and think critically about the messages they get about bodies and their value from media, school, and peers. We can make fat into just another neutral body descriptor, like describing someone as short or tall or blonde hair or brown hair. We can make fat good, because once we know that to be true, we have no reason to keep pursuing thinness at any cost. We can stop judging how our kids' bodies grow. We can reject the premise that our worth as parents or as people should be measured by our weight. When we do that, diet culture has nothing to feast on. Controlling your body size stops being the goal. We can't keep our kids in diet culture-free bubbles. The goal isn't to stop grandma from ever saying a bad word about bread. It's to help our kids know her bread comment doesn't apply to them. The goal isn't to make sure our kids never watch a cartoon with a stereotypical fat villain or a YouTube star on a detox. It's to teach them to think critically about the media they consume and to call out those instances of harm for what they are. The goal isn't to raise kids who never experience a moment of body anxiety. It's to teach kids who to blame when our culture makes them think their body size is their value. All kids need to know that all bodies are good bodies. All kids need to know that they are more than their appearance or eating habits or athletic abilities. They need to know that weight is not synonymous with health and that neither weight nor health has a moral value. And kids of all sizes deserve to feel in control of their bodies. They deserve to be able to say whether they are hungry or full or in the mood to try broccoli tonight. They deserve to say if they feel uncomfortable giving grandma a hug or with the way their track coach talks about their runner's body. They deserve to opt out of school assignments that teach dieting and to have a doctor who looks at them as a whole person, not a point on a growth chart. And every kid needs to understand, just like every adult needs to understand, that we live in a culture with anti-fat bias and that we can all work to change that. But we can make sure that our kids know that we trust their bodies and that home is the safe space. Thanks for listening. I hope you read Fat Talk and enjoy it and think about how to change these conversations in your own life.
Thank you, Virginia. That was Virginia Soul Smith with 5 big ideas from Fat Talk, Parenting in the Age of Diet Culture. Also, check out our book bite for Anxious Eaters, Why We Fall for Fad Diets. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.